This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
First of all, thank you all for coming. We're happy to celebrate the launch of our fourth title in the series of books that Apex Art has been publishing since 2006. This afternoon, we are fortunate to have three of the contributors to the publication here with us to give their thoughts on the topic of life between borders. They're all migrants themselves. The work and lives of these three are quite in line with the topic of the book. We have Sebastian Santamaria. How'd I do? He co-founded Residency Unlimited in 2009 and has been working with residents for years before that. Stephen Rand is an artist who started Apex Art in 1994 and has been challenging us with his thoughts on topics in the arts as well as life ever since then. Dr. Melissa Chu is the director of the Asia Society Museum and senior vice president for its global arts and cultural program. She's founding director of the Asia Australia Arts Center in Sydney, Australia, and has curated and written extensively on Asian art. And Niels van Tome, who also served as an advisor on the book, is a New York-based curator, researcher, and critic whose previous work has included the topic of migration. The topic of migration is very close to my heart. Before I moved away from the States, I always had a desire to live abroad and had the opportunity to when I moved to Greece nearly a decade ago for 6 years. In the same way that I thought I would always be in New York when I moved here, I really thought I'd stay in Athens forever with that move. As probably everyone in this room can attest, things don't always turn out as we plan. My latest move, bringing me full circle back to my hometown, is not the same. I didn't return to Wisconsin with the intention of staying, but let me tell you, life there is very familiar. I find it easy to navigate my way around and function within the culture, which is obviously much different than life in a big city. The differences that I see are, it's easy to recognize the differences between New York and Eau Claire in just the 19 hours since I've been here this trip. The pace in Eau Claire suits me fine, and hey, people are friendly there. This is one of the issues Life Between Borders was looking to address. At what point do we feel we fit into a new location when we move? We also asked the authors to consider topics such as the general effects of the nomadic lifestyle and questions such as, is it possible to conceive of a truly multicultural society in a world without borders? We also asked if nomadism is actually a choice and if living the nomadic life is really as romantic and ideal as we think. For those of you who have read the book, you know that we had a wide range of responses from the 10 contributors about their own experiences of nomadism. From keeping a library while traveling, to sharing personal stories of growing up nomad, to examples of artworks that address the topic of migration, Life Between Borders provides many stories that most people can relate to. We all know artists and curators and critics with line after line of bio information. We want to know where they were born, where they're currently based, and the many interactions they've had in various locations. Knowing this locational background seems an important part of understanding who someone is. The nomadic life touches more and more of us as we increasingly travel. Undoubtedly, everyone in the audience today has a personal experience of living in a new place and thoughts about how they reacted to each new location and situation. After everybody here gives some of their own perceptions of moving around, we'll have time for a short discussion afterwards. And we're going to start with Stephen Rand. He's going to read to you from his introduction to the book, and then each of the panelists will speak. So thank you.
So I'm in Artistan, a smallish city with a great cafe that I'm sitting in right now. There are several galleries, a museum, and a small arts community. The openings I attended were very nice. And the dinner after the museum opening was in a beautiful home. The guests were seated in order of relevance, and the food was artfully arranged. Everyone spoke English, as noted by Croatian artist Mladen Stilinovic in his 1992 work, An Artist Who Cannot Speak English is No Artist. A lot of art is about irony. Until recently, inexpensive plane fares made it easy to move the body with a lot of travel. Until recently, inexpensive plane fares made it easy to move the body. With a lot of travel, the psychocultural issues of displacement and isolation arrive later, like network packets. For many young curators and artists, traveling the globe and living in new places is projected to be the most essential and meaningful of pursuits. Many mid-career creatives are still attached to the romantic life of travel, hearkening back to romantic literature and cinema. Travel has changed, and the locations one romanticizes about have changed. The arts can have an unintentional consequence of opening up locations and then turning them inside out. Among the lions, tigers, elephants, and ungulates in Africa, there is also now a Four Seasons hotel to accommodate the travelers that follow the artists. With issues of looking different in a homogenous culture such as being African-American in Korea, one of our outbound residents, or if you blur your identity in heterogeneous locations such as New York City, you will likely be asked for directions or hear the local dialect of your language spoken on the street. If your travel allows you to avoid intimacy or involvement, the risk can be high. Sometimes it ends up being a search for oneself. Some cultures ignore privacy, while being alone is a sign of loneliness in others. Our residency program at Apex Art is described as a simulated move to another city. It sounds a bit theatrical, but the program is a cultural immersion done largely on one's own in a new city. In a bit of reversal, our residents must be over 30 years old and never been to the city they are sent. Additionally, they are recommended by someone we approach, such as an adjunct faculty member in the city selected, in an effort to circumvent the gatekeeper situation that the art world often creates in an exclusionary process. We do not provide a studio, no career networking, and no map with directions to artisans' art locations. Rather than putting them in a restricted art environment studio, doing the same thing they were doing before they arrived, we provide each resident with a rigorous schedule of social and cultural activities that they are expected to follow. We do set up meetings, but they are not promotional, and they are not intended to introduce the residents to artistinians for a quid pro quo. People we already know and who were likely at the last fair or biennial. I'm sorry, I've lost some of my as I copy. Some countries consistently dominate interests as others become transitional, and certain countries attract artists. Berlin is a current hot city. New York and London had their time, and long ago there was Paris. The art world went through Italy, New York, Germany, then Russia. Recently, smaller Eastern European cities like Croatia and Ljubljana were centers of discussion. Not sure, but right now it seems you are halfway through China. It's a moving marketplace, and relocation always brings up personal issues of inclusion, rejection, and purpose. Skype helps, but it's not the same as real life integration. Often we cannot wait to get there and then cannot wait to leave. What does nationality mean in a place like Artisan? Is the currency hard or social? What is important and what is not? Travel and location, relocation encourages this kind of thinking. Our life is in a box. When we relocate, we bring our virtual home with us. We bring our computer with our pictures, our music, our writing, our reading, and our news. Video chats have replaced the local TV station we once tried to watch in foreign countries to combat a sleep-shifted evening. We live in a kind of travel trailer existence with our tech-based life. It allows us not to travel when we travel. But as long as the cafe has Wi-Fi, I'm happy. Just shortly, I'd like to do a couple of quick thank yous before we go on. First, I'd like to thank my co-editor in the series of books, Heather Felty. She's done a great job with maintaining our level of productivity and actually laying out all the books in-house. This, as she may have mentioned or you'll notice, is our fourth publication. Secondly, I was going to thank James Pierce, who has been with us for 5 years and is now going to be leaving. And he was going to be with us today, but he's not here, so we'll just have to tell him when we get back. And, of course, thank you to all the folks who are on the panel and have contributed to the book. We appreciate that so much. And because we have so few people here, you're going to get a free book today.
Look under your chairs. It's a free book. Anything else, Stephen?
No.
Okay.
Other than the parts that I forgot to bring with me.
Okay. We're going to start with Sebastian, then, if you want to say a few words.
Okay. Hello, everyone. Does that work? Okay. So first, I'd like to thank also Apex, Heather, and Stephen for inviting me to write on this subject matter. Initially, I was a little surprised to be invited because I'm not an academic type or a writing type guy at all. But then I was sort of reassured by how Apex Art is really the apex when it addresses specific subjects. And I could see you guys thinking like, oh, he might have something good to say about the subject matter. And it's not important to be, you know, of an academic rank or, you know, professional rank to share your thoughts on that. So I just wanted to thank you for giving me that opportunity. Looking back at when I wrote it, I would almost probably want to write a million other things since then, because it has sparked a whole train of thought that I always come back to since I actually wrote the essay and became more conscious about this notion of mobility and borders and nomadic lifestyle, which I've kind of sort of evaded in the last 10 years. So the essay itself is really biographical. I grew up to parents who were nomadic, working in the Foreign Service. So we moved around essentially every 3 years, 3-4 years, from one country to the next. I would say that I'm the antipode of someone who lived in one place all their lives. And to a point where if I meet someone who's actually lived in one place for their entire life, I look at them with awe and excitement and like, tell me everything about it. What was it like? Which is often what I get when people, you know, learn about what I do and what I've lived, you know. So it's very hard for me to say, yeah, I've always wanted to go to that place because I was forced to do it, essentially. Or I had the privilege of doing it, if you look at it that way. And in the essay, basically, I conclude that this lifestyle has, without a doubt, been an influence in everything that I do in my life, both personally, professionally, and geographically. So by this, I mean I moved around a lot till I was in college, and then I moved to New York, and then I said, okay, I'm going to stay here in this one place. And inherently, after 10 years, I've moved around every 2 or 3 years from one part of the city to another. So I've just essentially been doing the same thing, but on a smaller geographical scale. And it's affected my creative process probably since the beginning. So I did go to art school and realized when I started Residency Unlimited, which is an international residency program here in New York, why was I going to start a nonprofit and be an arts administrator when I was supposed to be an artist? And I just thought back to, even in school, I was inherently nomadic, jumping from one practice to another, not wanting to be put in a framework of, I am this type of artist following this type of practice. And I did that back then very unconsciously. Now I'm much more aware of it. So when I decided to start Residency Unlimited, I kind of was like, yeah, I have to. This is my only choice because this is the best thing that I do. In writing the essay and a little talking about that, I then started having lots of conversations with people, went on a residency program myself, and realized that borders are very flexible and not, they're, how would you say it? They're elastic, or they're subjective. Borders are subjective. And just to backtrack a little bit, what I do at Residency Unlimited is support visual artists coming to New York in a residency program for 3 to 6 months, and we help them, we hold their hands and help them as much as possible on their practice, on their networks, on their programmatic activities. And so what I realized is that inherently I've become the other role. So the welcoming committee, or the people that get to be exposed to the nomads and be exposed to the people that travel. And my upbringing has made that this easiest thing to do, in like I do it automatically. It's not a burden for me, it's actually a pleasure to do that. I get a lot of people asking me, you know, how do you do it? How do you work with artists? And I don't even consider it a problem. You know, it's really a pleasure to do that. It's a challenge. Since that, it was almost a year since I wrote the essay, I've talked to a lot of people and sort of become much more aware of informal borders. So erase subjective, informal borders. And how basically moving around is only really, really interesting when you activate those communities and the people that you encounter and the societies that you go into and maintain them. Informal networks, in a sense, are much more robust than structural networks. So, you know, when there's an earthquake, there's no more buildings, but there's the people that are standing there. And it's your relation to them that is going to really stand the test of time. And so then I realized that this is a full-time job, and being, you know, socially engaged, and by socially engaged I mean being with people, paying attention to them, caring about what they do, sharing information, being curious, comes very easily because of this possibility of moving around. But then it's also literally a full-time job. I mean, it's almost exhausting. I would say I'm a classic New Yorker in the sense that I work with people all the time, and then I get home and then I stare at a wall till I fall asleep. You know, and then everyone asks me, like, what show should you go to? And I'm like, I don't know. I haven't been to MoMA in 3 years. But then to address these informal networks and this activating of communities that, you know, that you bounce off of, and inherently there's this border that you have to cross, that is also equally subjective and sometimes vaporous or even emotional. And I'm going to use, I thought about this last night, and I apologize beforehand, an example of like a nightclub. So say you want to get into a nightclub because it's a hip and happening place, and there's a huge line, and you're trying to get into this place, and inherently you have to pass some form of social exam to be able to get in. Once you get in and you embed yourself within that little world, that border, that wall, that door that you go through, it kind of disappears in your head. It no longer becomes an obstacle because you're already in. And you go in and you high-five the DJ and you have a drink and, you know, you become part of this thing. And then the next time you go through it, it's like you don't even think twice about it. And I've seen this happen with a lot of artists that come to New York, where they have this preconceived notion of going into the other, and then once you're there, that just evaporates. And then the challenge is to maintain that open connectedness. And then it depends on who you are and what you do. So, I would say that the act of being nomadic is really important. I mean, for me, it's super important, and it really helped. It's caused my vocation to be quite successful. Residency Unlimited started 5 years ago. We had one artist. Now we have 19 at a time. So it's great. And that inherently comes from being with people, and being with people that move around a lot. So I'll close it at that, and then you guys can ask confused questions later.
Okay, thank you. Melissa, do you want to start?
Sure. Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me here. My contribution to the book was a little bit more on a kind of a looking back on some of the exhibitions and kind of framing of Asian art here in the United States. And I thought I would address that a little bit later in my talk today. I thought I'd start actually with a little bit of more of a biographical introduction, just in the sense that since all of us have been quite personal, I felt that I should add to that. My background, which often is puzzling to people when I travel in Asia, because I'm known as the American lady because I represent an American institution here. Asia Society, it was founded over 50 years ago with this idea that Americans needed to, in the future, understand and through education would better understand Asia. And so the museum, about 15 years ago, we began to show Asian contemporary art, making us one of the first museums to focus in on really presenting artists here in New York. My own background is that I came to New York about 13 years ago, and before that had lived in two cities in Australia. My father is Chinese, my mother's Australian. And the circumstances of growing up, I think, in a place like Australia was very different from today. Although many people assume that, it is of course, a very, what one calls today a multicultural environment. But I came at professional age at an interesting moment because Australia politically and economically was looking to the Asia-Pacific region to really form a kind of an economic bloc in the same way that the European Union was in formation in the 1990s. And then Clinton also had NAFTA. And so politically, Australia wanted to form a kind of an Asia-Pacific group, which they did through what's known today as APEC. And so there are a lot of opportunities to travel in that region and do exhibitions and residencies and all sorts of things. So I was a kind of beneficiary of that, although when I began to think about being a curator in a place like Sydney, I had not really an idea that I would ever have necessarily a focus on Asia. It was almost a product of the timing. In that there were so many opportunities to really travel across the region, and it was an issue of proximity too, that a flight to somewhere like Indonesia is only 8 hours, and I know for most Americans that sounds like a long flight, but for an Australian that's nothing. I couldn't quite believe it when I would be here in New York City and people would complain about jet lag in the transatlantic flight from London to New York, because that was really the bare minimum of a flight to get off the continent of Australia. So, you know, this idea of being nomadic, I think, is an interesting one that we, all of us, are kind of speaking about today. I think that for me, it's not necessarily been an experience of being nomadic, but rather, I guess, less grounded in an idea of citizenship. So for me, growing up in a bicultural household, Chinese, Australian, I never fully identified with necessarily being Australian. And I think that has enabled me to work with artists, I guess, on projects across the world, but mostly throughout the Asia-Pacific region. in a kind of different way, because I was never interested in a lot of the kind of bilateral or political kinds of relationships that sometimes ensue. My academic study took that interest a little bit further, and I, in the late 1990s, became very interested in what was going on in China. I had been, my father actually wanted to take me to the Three Gorges before the Three Gorges were dammed. So in the early 1990s, took me on a trip, and I was able to visit some artists then, which is today in the very early stages of what we would ordinarily have called the experimental art scene, which had begun in 1979, but in the early 1990s really started to take shape. And from that, started to do more research and embarked on a PhD. And I remember vividly my professor saying to me, "Melissa, you cannot do a PhD on Chinese contemporary art because there are..." I mean, she said to me, "How many books are there on that subject?" And I said, "2, and they were published last year." And she said that it's not an academic field of inquiry, and it's probably doubtful that you'll ever get a job. And I think it was just through sheer stubbornness that I wouldn't give it up. And, you know, today it's very much it's a new field of academic inquiry, yes, but it's also a source of great attention. And so I'm glad that I did persist in that case. But my PhD was not just on Chinese art per se. What I was really interested in is the condition of diaspora, that there was a whole group, in fact, there was an exodus in the 1980s, so much so that it was given a name. It was called Leave the Country Fever, and scores of artists left China through any opportunity. I remember Yun Feiji, who's an artist who just used to live here in New York City, but he ended up in Arkansas, and I said to him, "How did you end up in Arkansas?" And he said, "Well, you know, the school admissions book is about that thick for America," and he really was just going down the list, and Arkansas starts with an A, so he ended up in Arkansas. But all of them found places in universities and also through museum exhibitions to come to places like New York, Sydney, and Paris, and so that was very much my focus. And it was a really interesting focus on a case study of diaspora. What happens when a whole group of maybe 30 or 40 key artists leave the country, settle in different cities? What happens to their work? How do they change how they think about themselves? And I think that one of the things I often say to people is that the most remarkable thing you can do is actually leave your home city or home country, because it forces you to think about yourself in a really different way. And for these Chinese artists, what was interesting, if you compare their work and their opinions about themselves to those who stayed in places like Beijing, is that they became much more identified with being Chinese. Their works were all about Chinese identifiers, signifiers, symbols, which is completely in contrast to their peers who stayed at home in China. And so that was kind of one of the elements that I was grappling with. But each city had a different way of receiving these artists, which kind of played into it. So, you know, it was partly my own experience, I think, in Australia being kind of bicultural, that I also became interested in these kinds of subjects. And I think as we think about this idea of life between borders, I think it's much more of a condition today than ever before. People are much more mobile. Large migrations are actually happening mostly because of economic interests. You know, if you look at even a place like Dubai today, over 80% of the population are not local. In fact, they're foreigners. And most of them are from places like Pakistan, who are there for 3 years or so to work in very difficult circumstances and then migrate back. So I think that both the pathways of migration have completely changed, and people's ability to seek out employment that mobility has enabled it. So with that in mind, I had just a couple of images that I wanted to show, only because I was thinking through in a kind of more exhibition-related way. some of the changes that had happened over the last few years. And so I couldn't help but think, being here in New York, this image that Alfred Barr mapped out in 1936 about modernism, it's kind of the standard trope that we might use to explain how we all learned about modern art at school. And I think that in terms of difference and kind of the idea of opening up beyond the European and American central kind of axis, that we see where Asian artists can start to enter a kind of an idea that, you know, there are centres beyond Europe and America. This is kind of an interesting one because it posits both Japan and Africa as sources of influence, right? And yet I think it was in the late 1990s that we started to see something else happen. And I do think that it was largely through the biennials and triennials that were in places like Gwangju in South Korea. Even Shanghai had one later in 2000. Sydney, Australia had one. It was one of the earliest. But in peripheral places, you started to see biennials in the late 1990s happen. And what the development that I think helped a lot of artists who weren't living in New York was that it formed a kind of alternate circuit outside of the kind of citadel of museums. So another type of artist started to be given exhibition opportunities. And when we think of nomadism, I always think of Kim Soo-ja's Bataris, which are a great symbol of kind of getting up and having to move, meaning Bataris are these large bundles that are where, you know, in Korea it's a real tradition. If you moved house, you basically didn't pack things in a box or a crate. You would pack them in a cloth and it would be essentially wrapped. And so she did this project for the Cities on the Move exhibition, which was one of those real international touring shows in the late 1990s, created by Hans Ulrich Obrist and Hu Hanru. But it really did kind of open up things for artists who'd lived in many different places. And so she took this, it was a kind of performance video where she really did gather the Bataris, the wrapping cloths and the bundles, and sit on a truck for 2,727 kilometres on this truck. And then there are, you know, in the late 1990s, a number of artists started to embody in their work this idea of them as nomads, that their existence, in a way, was very much about travelling. If you spoke to any of them, they had projects maybe in 20 different cities across the world, and, you know, you often wondered how they managed it. But, you know, here is an image by Hiroaki Sawa, a Japanese artist living in London, who... this is actually a video still, but it's a very quiet video that shows his own apartment in London being inhabited by or transformed into an airport. Or most recently, probably, an artist like Subodh Gupta, who is based in Delhi, who cast the airport trolley and bundles in bronze and brass. And when you go to certain airports, there are, you know, people don't necessarily use suitcases, that their household goods are bundled up in this way. And so he's made them, obviously, here into a much precious, much more precious kind of art object. But out of all of the artists, I kind of ended with this in terms of artwork, because I'm very interested in these new... systems or routes or pathways. And I think that these two artists from Kazakhstan who've collaborated on a video called A New Silk Road actually mapped out the old Silk Road, from which was essentially about the transportation of goods from China through Iran to Europe in the ancient world. And here they're mapping out the new Silk Road, which is still about the transportation of goods from China, but in this case, China as that manufacturing hub. You know, we know most objects we have in our houses are made in China, and so here it's this idea of transportation of goods. And then finally, the point I kind of wanted to make was that when we think of museums, since I represent a museum on this panel discussion, when we think of museums, we more often than not think of the museum infrastructure in a place like New York City. And if you think of the last two centuries, the 19th century was really characterized by the formation of collections largely in court collections or royal collections that then became museums, became public institutions. The 20th century saw most of that growth here in the United States, and if New York City is one of those great examples with the formation and establishment of great institutions like MoMA and the Guggenheim that have become, of course, the transition from private to public institutions. And now we see much more development in a place like Asia. The Chinese government recently made an announcement that they intend to build 1,000 new museums in the next decade, but now we are seeing 3,000 new museums. And I just wanted to share with you a couple of images of those new developments. This is an image from a private museum in Shanghai called the Aurora Museum that was actually set up by a Taiwanese businessman who obviously has business in mainland China, but he has a very strong collection of Chinese jades and porcelain and commissioned Tado Ando to do the interior of his space. And a couple of weeks ago, I was at the opening of this. It's part of a new development in Shanghai. It's along the West Bund, but this is an example of the Long Museum. So another private museum. Tan Dun had done a performance for the opening. So you see here, and then the final image that I wanted to end on, which is a little bit of a caution with the kind of what I might say is the flattening out of art history or the way that so many curators travel today. I think that there's often an assumption that there are the same influences for all artists. And so one concern I think I have is in terms of the reading of objects and art. And this I've put this as an example of, you know, often the assumption with this work by Wang Guangyi is that because it was named as part of a movement, a political pop movement in the early 1990s in Beijing that occurred, there's this assumption that Warhol was actually the main reference. And actually, it was not. It was mostly the Cultural Revolution, which was a period in the 60s and 70s in China. And so I think that we just have to be really careful as we travel the world. We know that we bring certain assumptions with us in the interpretation of art, you know, artwork. And so I would just encourage curators to think also about, you know, what are the kind of local regional references that might be also at play. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa. Niels, do you want to start?
Sure. I'm going to open up. Well, first of all, thank you so much, Stephen and Heather, for inviting me today. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you also for coming. I know it's a wonderful day outside and that we're blocked from sunlight, but I'll try to go as fast as possible. I would like to start my presentation today with an excerpt from Bosnian artist Damir Niksic's Immigrant Song, a video he produced in 2008 at a time when he was a recent immigrant to Sweden.
And I say I'm here, I chose to be here. And you say no, you cause we let you be here. And I say I'm here, cause I choose to be here. And you say no, you cause we let you be here. And I say I'm here because I want to be here. And they say no, you here, cause we let you be here. And I say I'm here cause I choose to be here. And he's saying, no, you hear. because we let you be here. And I say I'm here because I wanted to be here. And you say no, you're here because we let you be here. And I say I'm here because I choose to be here. And you say no, you're here because we let you be here. And I say I'm here because I want to be here. And then you say you're here because we let you be here. And I say I'm here. I'm here because I want to be here. And then you say, no, you're here because we let you be here.
Of course, it gives me some kind of perverse curatorial satisfaction that I can choose when I don't want Damir Nixit's video to be here. But regardless, in my short talk, which is based upon...
Can you go a little bit closer to the mic?
Okay. Am I good?
Yeah.
In my short talk, which is based on my essay from the book, The Trouble with the Migrant Metaphor, I would like to address the contemporary appearance of the figure of the migrant, in particular as a generative counterpoint to our celebration of the so-called new nomadic lifestyle. Two modes of experience that have often been collapsed in contemporary discourse. If this lifestyle is characterized by a relentless passing through diverse social, cultural, economic, and geographic spheres, then the migrant, despite its transitory identity, should be seen as a static figure. Being relocated from her home, she is importantly excluded from the cosmopolitan freedom of movement that distinctly defines the former state. Hers is precisely a life, not a lifestyle, determined by a totalizing existential disruption instead of the privilege of a free choice. According to Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek, it is too easy to start, quote, praise the hybridity of the postmodern migrant subject, no longer attached to specific ethnic roots. As for her, this supposed hybridity designates a very tangible traumatic experience of never being able to settle down properly, an experience full of anxiety and demanding great effort, a traumatic shock which destabilizes her entire existence. End quote. A similar conceptual discrepancy can be found in today's contemporary art world, namely through its equation of the underprivileged migrant worker with the internationally traveling art worker. More specifically, such ideas are literally translated in a number of discourses associated with the idea of the artist or the curator as migrant, such as curator Katja Kobold's statement that, start quote, both artist and migrant embody the capacity of translating personal, social, and political experience, and both are believed to function in a way which transcends national borders, end quote. This gesture is all too often emphasized when the art community seeks to highlight its supposed flexible, dynamic, and ever-changing transnational nature, an idea which has prompted the writing of my essay in the book. To be clear, the art worker should be understood here not so much as the individual artist or curator, but as a vastly expanding international network of artists and curators who move freely between residencies, biennials, academies, and other professional frameworks. Beyond evoking the problematic nature of the above-mentioned one-dimensional equation, the question remains how one can critically approach the realness of such a vast and ungraspable subject matter as migration through the realm of contemporary artistic practices. To do so, I have evoked two artworks in my essay for the book, Damir Nixit's Immigrant Song, from which I just showed an extract, and Claire Fontaine's Foreigners Everywhere, which is an ongoing series of neon pieces installed in public spaces and differing cultural contexts across the world that translates the sentence "foreigners everywhere" in a diversity of languages, except, importantly, English. Here you can see an image of Claire Fontaine's "Foreigners Everywhere" as it is installed at the Aspen Museum in Aspen, Colorado. Here the sentence is translated in the Ute language, which is the original language of the inhabitants of that area, who by now, of course, have disappeared. There's no need and time to go into the specific analysis of these pieces here, and if you want to find out more about them, I urge you to buy the book I wrote here, but actually if you get it, there's no need to buy it. You can just read it on your trip back on the subway. However, I think it's important to underscore that both works reflect critically upon the migrant condition while playfully negotiating the topic of migration. They do so through a complex interplay of experience and research, critical conceptual thought, and aesthetic mediation. In constructing a thought process about migration, the works under consideration ultimately show that there is a distinct divide between the migrant and artist subject, two states of being which cannot constructively be equated with one another, but which can be thoughtfully explored through artistic practices. Migrants, who are thrown into an uncertain and unpredictable future, experience far-reaching issues of exclusion and displacement as explored indirectly in the works by Niksic and Claire Fontaine on a day-to-day basis. For them, this is not about an aesthetic understanding, but the reality of their daily lives. The broader question I would like to address, thus, is how radical experiences of exclusion, as explored by Niksic, and antagonism, as explored by Claire Fontaine, can relate to the new nomadic lifestyle of art workers who often refer to the migrant paradigm and its supposed hybridity, as Žižek was quoted earlier, as a prerequisite for their own lives. How can one possibly conceptually link such alienating and incompatible existential condition when one's lifestyle depends on the smooth global flow of cultural capital and artistic exchange? And in which way can a new emerging class of international art workers can relate oneself to another developing class of permanent migrant workers if their fundamental subjective experience depends on in rather than exclusion? Exile, of course, is much more appealing as a metaphor than it is as an existential experience. When in early 2011, in the wake of the political unrest in the Middle East and North Africa, the Mediterranean island of Lampedusa was overflown by a steady influx of migrants, the island was forced to open up the gates of its detention center, and the entire island of Lampedusa became a migrant camp. Some of the local inhabitants opened the Museum of the Immigrant, for which they scraped together the 400 euros in monthly rent themselves. And here is an image of this museum on Lampedusa. And I quote here from an article by journalist Katerin Peters, published in Der Spiegel. "It's not much more than a windowless room with a stone floor, but it's full of memories. Objects the refugees have lost or left behind are displayed on wooden boards, a comb, a pot, an ashtray, a telephone book, a mirror, a single sneaker, Korans and Bibles. These aren't just objects," says Dankona, an inhabitant of the island. "They're clues that tell us something about people's dramas, or dreams, better." She and a few friends found many of the objects on the beach. Others are items that less fortunate refugees were carrying with them when they died. Needless to say, the institutional structure of the blooming, autonomous, well-funded spaces of 21st century artistic production its numerous museums, artist-in-residence programs, biennials, schools, exhibition spaces, research centers, etc., could not be farther removed from the real spaces that migrants, such as those on Lampedusa, inhabit. If the global art worker really wants to connect to the struggle of migrants worldwide, she shouldn't attempt to establish tenuous links between these disparate worlds, an impossible and unattainable act, as I explore in more depth throughout my essay. Instead, she should find novel ways of joining the fight against the injustices these people inevitably face. For the artist and curator are privileged figures who can creatively propose new possibilities of equality, social justice, and consciousness from within the aesthetic domain. Thank you.
Do you want to ask any questions, or should we speak between us for a moment and then open up to you guys? One of the problems, I think, in nomadicism is you go from the personal to the universal as you travel, and you go from the specific to the general. Do you find that in your experiences or the experiences of the artists or residents that you may have dealt with, is it an opening experience for them? Is it a frustrating experience? This small kind of then relating to the nomad, do they lose their sense of self culturally?
Was that question asked to
for
me?
For all three, okay. I think, right?
Anybody that finds it. I was specifically thinking of Suja, for example. Mm. You know, when you take things that you grew up with and you bring them to the outer world, you change the context, and then you also change your entrance into the world because it becomes this large situation. So I wonder, have you found difficulty, again, either with yourselves or with artists, going from the small to the universal and then trying to somehow make that personal in some way?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think that that's actually one of the biggest challenges for artists today who choose to go this route in terms of making international something that is essentially something very local and specific. I think the biggest shift that we've seen is that, in fact, where once artists, if they really wanted to be successful, would have to live in a place like New York, Paris, London, or Berlin. But today, actually, I think that they're much better off staying where they began, you know, that in fact I think that the bigger cities, when they, if they're producing work like this, and this is not about Suja at all, but I'm just speaking very generally, that sometimes it's much harder to continue to make work in this fashion if you are removed. But, you know, I mean, it's very difficult to generalize. I think that the experience for artists is a very different one today from even what it was 10 years ago, in fact. And, you know, many of them actually choose to live in very far away places and still engage in an international art world, and that works well for them. But, yeah, I mean, I think in terms of the production of work, though, I think that in terms of the production of work, that it's a real challenge to... I mean, I think that it's easier in the first few years to do work like this, but I think it's very difficult to continue. Like, if you look at some others of her peers, like, there was a whole generation of them, whether it was Shirin Neshat or Tsai Kuo Chang or others, who really came to the fore at this very moment, around 1997 in the Biennales. Okay. And if you look at the routes that these artists have gone, they've been very different, but at the most successful of them, they have been able to retain something that is very personal rather than generically cultural.
I have a question for each of you, and I'll give it out. Sebastian, how often do you become a therapist for your charges?
Not as often as I would think I should be. actually. And I've asked myself that question as to why. I think New York is particular for artists when they come here because it does have this gravitas of being this, a whirlpool of the art world. And so everyone here is kind of, when they get to New York, they're on their game, I would say. There's less, I'll say less emotion, but everyone sort of keeps it together. And so my therapeutic skills are not really put into play. That being said, the act of working with people is, I would say, is an 8 day a week job. I mean, it's there's times where I would, you know, I wish I was living in a farm and just cutting logs for 3 weeks without, you know, like I do think that would be great. But inherently, it brings its other rewards. So it's not a burden actually to be emotionally open to artists, especially when they're in this state of alertness and sensitivity. I mean, I would say when one travels, I think even neurologists say, you know, if you go outside of your habitual environment, your neurons in your brain react completely differently, and as such, so to be working with people that are in this sort of much more alert and sensitive state actually encourages them not to be, you know, psychopathic, I would say.
It works.
It works, yeah, it does. It actually does work, yeah.
Okay. And Niels, one of the things that you did in your essay that you didn't really address too much here are the social ramifications of people who are nomadic, not by choice. We have a very fortunate situation in the art world. We travel. And the worst situation we have is we travel coach. You know, and as bad as that is, other people are traveling under cars and doing all kinds of things. So you seem to take the cause of the people that that were unintentional nomads. Has the art world successfully tried to integrate this sensibility or be sensitive to that difference?
I think so. But there remains that contradiction, of course, that, you know, an artistic statement remains metaphorically, whereas we're talking, I'm juxtaposing it with a real life experience, an existential experience. On the other hand, I do think there are some instances where artists have successfully engaged with this topic matter. I made an exhibition in 2011 called Where Do We Migrate To? Which was shown at the Center for Art, Design, and Visual Culture in Baltimore, then traveled to New York, to the New School, to New Orleans, and it's currently still traveling. It's going to Sweden in 2015. But one of the, I also want to go back a little bit to that idea of universality. I don't think that exists. I think there is a problem with thinking that you know art will be read similarly in different cultural contexts across the globe. And I don't think that doesn't mean that you shouldn't show specific artworks in a specific context, but that means that you know always have to contextualize it or intentionally misread it. That's of course also an option, which can be of course creative. And but one of the things that I thought was like, okay, I always consider myself a Belgian curator, although I live in New York. But when I go back to Belgium and I talk about potential projects there, they see me as a New York curator. So I'm always like, oh, whereas I'm like now working on a project in Belgium, people think, oh, finally he's doing something abroad. Whereas I'm like, no, I'm actually doing something at home. But when I was asked to think about where do we migrate to in a European context, I thought that was a completely different story. then showing that exhibition in the United States. Although I love the idea of traveling exhibitions internationally, I also think they change the interpretation of the exhibition, the context of the exhibition changes. And also artworks, their readings change, and some new appear in new editions of the exhibition. But yes, I would say that in a sense, I'm not sure if the migrant experience and its existential consequences can be translated in the visual realm solely. So I think there will always be a discrepancy between an artistic mediation of something and the actual experience.
Do artists have any responsibility in that respect, or only the general social responsibility that everybody has?
I find the term responsibility so heavy, but I think they do. I think curators as well as artists have a responsibility in being sensitive to these differences. In that respect, I found it more interesting than that. For example, you could maybe frame work about migration as political art. If you can generalize. Rather than critiquing something or illustrating something through an artistic medium, it's maybe more interesting to mediate that problematic within the piece itself. And that's where, for me, if within the piece itself all those contradictions can lay bare on the table to analyze, I think then an artwork perhaps has successfully mediated, its own role and its own responsibility and mode of representation within that context.
I ask because I see the divide between social conscience and the accumulating art world to be ever widening, not becoming more guilt-ridden and aware.
No, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, that actually brings up notions from another essay, that where they talk about how nomads have no opinions, almost, or the notion of the freelancer, and how they don't have really that many beliefs, or so they're sort of in it for themselves. It brought up that thought.
As a survival mechanism or just as an egocentric mechanism?
Maybe both, it evokes like Clint Eastwood walking into a town as a stranger and everyone going like, who are you? And then he's like, I got my own rules, kind of. and it's for himself, but then it's also for the survival of whatever it is that he's doing.
I agree with this. It's an interesting idea. Actually, earlier this week, I was leafing through old cabinet issues, or older, and I came upon this article by Claire Lister about logistics. There's nothing to do with what we're talking about today, but she brings up this idea of intellect, which is an idea which was brought up by George Simmel in the early 20th century, which is a kind of self-defense mechanism that allows oneself to navigate urban centers. And this is kind of like a desensitized, blasé attitude. And in a way, I thought, like, maybe we just need to cultivate a new type of intellect that allows us to navigate these 21st century transnational structures. And I think, speaking from my own experience, that's the only way you can survive in these kind of contexts.
Well, Sebastian, you brought up the question that I was going to ask Heather. You're in Minnesota. No, you're in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin, but it's the same, you know. Really. Yeah, it's okay.
She deals with 25 degrees below zero, snow up to here, probably one of the weirdest environments that we all travel to in a certain sense. How do people look at you as, I mean, is the term nomad even a positive one, or do they just...
Well, I think that, see, there are a lot of people that I know who have stayed in the same city their whole life. Like, that's the norm there. Yeah. So you would really go nuts.
Like
you would, yeah, it would be a great experience for you. But so for me, I'm the oddity, but it's in a good way. And I say, wow, that's so cool. The same reaction that you had earlier, that's to me. It's like, wow, you lived in all these places. You've had all this exposure. I wish that I could know more about life in that way. So is that answer?
They accept you. They're not suspicious of you.
They're not suspicious. They're, if anything, they're jealous to have so much exposure.
Nice.
Yeah.
Do we have any questions?
Okay, we have a microphone, unless you want to speak up.
I'm loud.
Okay.
In the art world, what has this increased travel done to the idea of cultural capital, and is travel a competitive sport?
I'm done.
Sorry. You're done.
So can you repeat the question one more time?
Because it'll get recorded better.
Oh, okay. I asked, in the art world, what has this increased travel done to the idea of cultural capital, and is travel a competitive sport?
I can't afford to be in that competitive sport. Yeah, I mean, it's... By creative capital, for me it's a social reward, you know, like it's a, or there's sort of two factions. There's the artists that move around all the time and that are doing fairs and that are actually probably making a healthy living with showing their works in all these different environments, and then there's the faction of just these inherent travelers that are sort of gaining it for that social or experiential factor. So I think like the currency, it depends on what, you know, what you're doing. I don't know, in the last 10 years, traveling has been a little, it's changed a lot. It's not what it used to be, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Travel also becomes a weird situation because often people will come back from various trips and I'll say to them, oh, what'd you do? And they go, oh, I was in Turkey and I went to the biennial. I said, okay, well, what else did you do? And they went to the museum, they went to the exhibition, and they went to their hotel. And that's pretty much the extent of the traveling they did, even though they traveled so far. And this idea of competitive travel, it is a weirdly defined situation because people can put on a lot of miles and really not be very culturally sensitive at all. And that's often the distinction between the discussions I find between curators and their advocacy.
Yeah, I think actually one of the difficulties right now is that you can travel with such ease very superficially. So you can if you need to, you can dip in and out of a country one day, 2 days, do what you need. You know, that really wasn't possible before. And I think that the other thing we see a lot is places starting to look the same everywhere you go. So you stay in a hotel that is an international brand, you go to a shopping center with all the same shops, you know, you go to a museum with all the same artworks. It's kind of incredible. So
yeah, yeah.
That kind of, it's not universality, but it's something else. And I think, so the struggle is to find another way of engaging above and beyond that kind of obvious route. Yeah.
I actually just found out that all ports across the globe are designed, like redesigned by the same company. Mm-hmm. So whether you're strolling in Rotterdam, in Baltimore, or another port city, it would all look pretty similar. I've often been asked, like, why don't you never participate in a residency? Or, it's a very simple thing. It's just logistically impossible. So I love to do projects abroad. Love to do something specific that reflects the context where I'm working as well. But for me, it's just logistically not interesting to participate or to dedicate an entire month or 2 months or 6 months of my life and of my family life to this kind of new cultural field of art residencies. And I think there is also always the question of, okay, you can invite an artist, but what about, and then, I mean, what is the next step? Like, what are you actually facilitating? And I'm not sure if most residencies have reflected about that.
Do we have a nomad in the audience?
I'm probably the only person here who's not really in the art world. But I was interested in the topic because my family's done so much immigration and migration, okay? And it used to be, say, when my if someone needed a job, they would just go into the shop, prove what they could do, okay? When I see curators, you're talking about migration, I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, well, are you moving around because basically you're just like university adjuncts? Is no one really hiring you? Is there like no place to go? I would think to be a curator takes a lot of study and work and getting to know something and building up a name and sort of an integrity to what you're doing, having to write articles. And how do you develop that when you're moving around so much? I just find, I'll go to a museum, I'll go to an art gallery, it'll say curated by so-and-so who lives there. And I'm like, how do you get to know these people? How do you get to know artists? What's the infrastructure that supports you doing what you obviously love to do? And are you really, is this moving around freeing? Or is it kind of supporting something that's approved? Because, the photos about that Tando Ando, he's real well known. The Tun guy, he's well known. It's like, is it all the same people that you're promoting? I'm kind of interested in this.
Let the therapy begin.
Wants to take this.
Oh my God.
I can.
Well, I mean, what if, I grew up in like a small, tiny town without any, any future expectancies in a, really a shitty place in Belgium. I really wanted to leave. I really wanted to get out of there. And, through a detour, I came to curating when I was still living in Belgium. And by accident, I met somebody and curated a video screening that started to travel internationally. And at a certain point, I got married. And my partner was in Washington, D.C. And it was easier for me to move there. So I moved to D.C., and I have to say, that's why I think I can tell something about the migrant point of view, because I didn't move out of professional commitment. I moved because I wanted to be with my partner. Basically, I arrived in the U.S. without a working visa or without the possibility of even if I wanted to work somewhere and people wanted to work with me, it was impossible to pay me because, you know, that's how the infrastructure is. Just to say that, you know, you kind of like have to create this possibility yourself. I was lucky that I had the vision to organize a festival on art and politics in Washington, D.C. And while I was organizing that, one of the hosting institutions decided to hire me at that time, which gave me a working visa. Which then gave me the possibility to travel, to get involved on a different level within a bigger network of organizations. A lot of the things that happen also just happen because you're in specific situations and you kind of like have to move forward.
Just to quickly point out one thing. The term curator has become an all-encompassing term from people who are museum curators who are highly educated to people who are entrepreneurial and are not artists and want to be in the arts. Also to varying degrees of efficacy. Some are supported by their institution and are at a level of international notoriety. Other folks, everything from family support to no support. The art world is a very funny place. You can travel all around the world, and the art world is a comfortable little place, and you can go to it. People will take you to parties and do all of these things. If that's primarily what your interest is, yes, you can do that, and it's a very... Just by putting yourself in the role of curator, you have artists who want your time. So to all different degrees of efficacy, to all different degrees of interest, education, that is a great question. And yes, does that answer it a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's confusing to me because, like, I volunteer.
Probably not getting paid. No, they're probably not getting paid for, you know.
Oh, I think part of the intellect that I was talking about, that new 21st century intellect, should be about ethical standards that you adhere to as curator and as an artist. And I think one of the, it's often been said that, and I think it's partly true, that the artist has become a model, a role model for post-Fordist labor conditions. And I think it's true. We work without home, we work without without an overarching structure. We are precarious. We put ourselves in unstable situations and relationships. Everything can shift constantly. So I think the only thing that you have to hold on to is your ethical standards by which you work. And I think one of them, whether you work here in the United States or in Europe, I mean, one of the standards that I try to adhere to is financial remuneration, because otherwise, why would you? We're not in the service of providing free educational efforts or free labor. I think, you know, we have to be very strict about that.
Yes.
I was going to...
Take one more question.
Do you want to...
Well, if we have no more questions, we'll let you get
I have
to
one
the
question, which
oh,
is actually goes back to the question of ethics, and it's the it's a perhaps a point that's minor enough to be ignored, given how much travel there is in the world in general. But it's a question of the of ecology, actually, and the amount of travel that goes on in the art world that is perhaps not quite 100% always necessary. And this is about the green planet. And, you know, I have a wife who's an artist, and she travels from here all the way to Europe to look do a site visit, then to go back and have a discussion for 2 days, and then there's the show itself. And when you look at the number of hours that she's traveled and the pollution of the air just to have a show, I do wonder sometimes, you know, these questions that we need to really think about. And it's true that there are way more people who are not in the art world who are traveling, who do all kinds of business people, basically, right? So I don't think we should necessarily think that we are at the helm of destroying the planet via our travels, because the art world is actually minuscule, obviously. But I do wonder, since the art world is so much about the ethics of things, or it should be, or it can be, I wonder to what extent we should factor these kinds of things in. I've asked Nina, was it necessary to go all the way to London to have this conversation with somebody, you know? Or, I don't know, should we think about these questions at all, or no?
The only quick thing is, if you're spending somebody else's money, it changes what happens.
What does that mean?
Well, if it's a large institution, and they have the money to spend, and the curator or the staff are arranging these things, I suspect as a small institution, we would be cheaper and more effective in doing that.
Right, I'm sure you would be, yeah.
By necessity.
Yeah. Yeah, but that doesn't necessarily change the ethics of the people who actually do it. I mean, it's still...
It makes everybody feel good.
Yeah, it's a small thing.
Well, but there is the difference between a real personal interaction and that Skype screen that you look at.
Sure.
That you can't really contest. But, yeah, I mean, maybe there are probably many times where the Skype will probably be the simpler thing to do and just as effective. It depends. I mean, it also comes back to the question of time, you know, and to your first comments of how effectively doing something abroad is more chances of it being something pertinent and interesting when you actually do give it more time. And then the question is obviously, does one in this crazy world that we live in today have that time to do it and to want to physically devote that time?
It's funny that you mentioned that, Sina, because I just returned from Berlin. They flew me in for a project, for a meeting that lasted an hour and a half. I stayed for 5 days in Berlin for that meeting of an hour and a half, which I thought was wonderful. But in a way, you know, you can look at documents and you can look at proposals and you can look at the website of an institution, you can look at images. But, you know, in order to do a really relevant, meaningful, contextual project, I think you also need to be physically there. And the 5 days, I mean, I didn't just... I was partly a tourist, of course. I would never say the opposite. But it also allowed me to understand more of the context in which I will be working. Having said that, the ecology of traveling and of traveling exhibitions and of shipping artworks across borders, that's a different matter altogether. I think that's another panel discussion, really.
And to even exacerbate the situation, museums want more money every year. So, stop me if I'm wrong here. But I've heard where people, you have to spend what you have to ask for more the next year.
Not in my museum's case. I think that's often the case with government museums, especially, because they have to demonstrate that they have a need for that amount of funding in order to get the next year's, but not in mine. Sorry.
And then if you don't spend it, you turn on the heating and open up the windows.
Any other questions, or hog the mic suddenly?
I think we can probably just mingle around, and we should also thank Sina and Cabinet for hosting this session. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay.
Don't forget your free book. Thank
yes.
you all for coming.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you for a great panel. The recording will be on our site and on your site as well, if you'd like to send it to other people. There are free books here. Free chairs. What else? What else are you offering?
Free conversation.
Free conversation.
All right. Thank you, everybody,
thank
for
you.
Coming.